We are live in action. I feel like a Hollywood director sometimes. I've been doing so many recordings. Hey, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today, Josh. One of the reasons you are actually the first formal guest of the Learning Code All-Star Series is I've learned so much from you. So maybe we'll start with a brief introduction for yourself, and then I'll go on to how much just I've learned from you over the years.
Well, thank you, Henry. I'm honored. So my name is Josh Pelletier, for everyone who's watching and anyone who hasn't met me. And I didn't know that I was the first in the series. So I'm really honored, Henry. I've worked with a lot of students over the years, and I'm sure I'm not exaggerating when I say you're going to be one that I will never forget. So there are a lot of people in your life that you come across, and at least I found as a teacher, especially in this area, because I taught for about 5 or 6 years, I'll run into quite a few people and they'll recognize me from having been in my class. And sometimes it'll take me a minute, and then later I'm a little embarrassed on the spot. I wish I could have remembered them, and then something will kind of jog my memory. But Henry, you will never be one of those people for me. And we never interacted in the classroom environment. It was all outside of the classroom. So, I'm so happy to be here, joining your podcast and talking to you, and to know that I had some kind of an impact. Because I know for me, when I think back at the people who had an impact on my life, my education, those are very special people. So to know that I could be that for you means a lot to me. Just to tell folks who I am, I come from Sacramento. I went to an international baccalaureate high school. I'm the son of an English teacher. And I kind of had it in mind that I was going to be an English teacher ever since I was in high school, actually. I went away to college. I went to Santa Barbara City College, studied English. That was kind of always my trajectory. But pretty quickly, I realized that writing essays wasn't exactly what excited me. So after about a year and a half at Santa Barbara City College, another year or so at San Diego Mesa College, I transferred to UCSD and found that they had a major that was just right for me at the moment, because I wasn't quite ready to commit to something new, but it was called literature/writing. So you could take those literature classes that I knew and was comfortable with, and then I could dabble with creative writing. So I did a little bit of that, and then I realized that was the direction I wanted to go in. So from San Francisco State, or I went to San Francisco State after UCSD. Took 2 years off, actually worked at the UCSD Medical Center, wrote a very rough draft of what became a novella when I was in the MA program at San Francisco State. So I ended up spending 4 years at San Francisco State, first 2 years in a master's program. I earned a master's in English, and then I finished off with an MFA in creative writing with a focus in fiction writing. So as soon as I graduated from San Francisco State, I started working as an adjunct instructor in the Foothill De Anza District. And so that's kind of the chapter of my life where I met you. But I've been teaching in the district for a few years at that point. I've been teaching at Foothill. I'd been teaching at De Anza. I was also teaching at West Valley and occasionally at San Francisco State. And I was teaching everything from like English 1A and 1B, like the typical transfer level English classes that everyone stresses out about, to Introduction to Shakespeare and Introduction to Fiction Writing, which were just really fun classes to teach. And then the occasional literature class at like San Francisco State or somewhere else. But at the point that you met me, I had been working as an adjunct for about 5.5 years. And I loved it, and I was really frustrated with it. It was both an exhilarating and heartbreaking experience at the same time, being an adjunct professor. And I loved the interactions with the students, but there were just things about being an adjunct that were very, very difficult, not just for me, but I know for other people. And an opportunity presented itself to work in a newly created entity at Foothill College, the Teaching and Learning Center. At the time, this was around 2016. At the time, the TLC had kind of existed on campus and it sort of drifted from the library and different classrooms and was finally getting like a formal space and staffing. And so I became, I think, the first full-time staff person working in the TLC in addition to, you know, the faculty who are working there, like Katie Hawes, the director, and the different faculty tutors. I'd been a part-time faculty tutor in the TLC, and then I moved over. So when you met me, I had just started working as a classified, full-time classified employee at Foothill in the Teaching and Learning Center, sort of, coordinating the tutoring work that happened. And of course, I was hiring you to work as a peer tutor. And so that's a learning environment. So I guess you could make the argument that we had some teaching experiences in the sense that I had the pleasure of being, I guess what you could call a mentor in a work environment for you. But I really look at that time in the TLC fondly. I loved my time there, but I think the part that I enjoyed the most was being a supervisor for the peer tutors, you and Maria and the rest of that group, the cool cats, as we called ourselves. I look back on that time very fondly. So I don't know if that was the kind of introduction you're looking for. It kind of went all over the place.
No. But that was amazing. I mean, yeah. That was a perfect example of just how strong of a, I think, writer you are, because you were writing with your words, and there was a beginning, middle, and an end. That was so beautiful. I mean, that was kind of like a really nice introduction to the origin of our working relationship. And one of the things I have so much respect for you, Josh, is from the first moment we met, I think the very first moment was actually in the interview. I mean, I think I saw you in passing because I was doing homework in the Teaching and Learning Center, but it was in the interview, and Katie Howe was also there. So it was you and Katie. And you brought these really, really creative questions into the interview. And I was just like, holy cow, this guy really cares about who he brings onto the team, because I've never had questions asked to me in the hospitality world that were anywhere as in depth and thorough as the ones that you had thought out for me. And you also had set this tone where I was like, I really should take this position such as tutoring seriously. And this was, I think, before the tutor training class that I ended up taking with Natalia Menendez. Before that ended up being a really blessing in disguise. I mean, I remember when I first signed up for that tutor training class, I was like, oh my God, another class onto my school schedule. But I learned so much from that. And one of the reasons I learned so much in that class is because of the tone that you set for me in that interview. But it didn't take long when I started working as a tutor under you, that I really felt that, you know, traditionally you're my manager, right? We all use this word manager, manager this, manager that. Let me go talk to my manager. But really, you were an amazing leader. Like, sadly, I've never been in a classroom setting with you, Josh. And I mean, I feel like every time I have a conversation with you, like the one today, it is very much so like I am learning so much. But you really helped me reimagine what tutoring can be and reimagine what service can mean. And that played an essential part to who I am today, which is like my career goal is to become a community college educator now. And I would say you are part and parcel to that shift in mindset because of how serious you took your job, because of how cool and brilliant you are on a day-to-day basis when I interacted with you. Really, it really, you know, this is coming from deep down in the bottom of my heart. And I worked at the Teaching and Learning Center for probably 2 or 3 years before I ended up working with you. So were really, really special in that sense. That's actually one of the goals, I hope, in this dialogue, making this dialogue public, is that there are many opportunities for us to learn outside of the classroom setting. And if students can begin exploring opportunities to work or have little internships or just be able to help out and contribute onto their local communities on a campus, it can really, really help them thrive and see themselves in ways that they never were able to see themselves. Because how many conversations have we had, Josh, where you're helping me with scholarship essays, right? And what is scholarship essay besides a really focused time and reflecting about the story, the student's origin story and who made an impact in their lives? And it was within those conversations that, you know, helped me or propelled me to reimagine a life that I can live, that I can be a proud of, right? So that is one of the primary focuses of this dialogue, which is classes are important. Classes are, you know, the first and foremost, do well in your classes, learn as much as you can, and, you know, go into office hours. But let's not forget about the opportunities that exist at an institution such as Foothill College, where students can hopefully explore, you know, and so much of that begins with dialogue, begins with having conversation, right? I don't think I would have started working at the Teaching and Learning Center had I not had deeper conversations with Valerie Fong. And I think she ended up referring me to Katie, and then Katie even referring to you. So it's within the dialogue, within the curious mindset, where we can really discover ourselves. So just praise to you, Josh. I've written many journal entries about my experiences with you that I haven't shared with you yet, but one day when I refine them a little bit more.
I think I should pause for a second, first of all, to say, well, I mean, thank you for sharing that with me. I'm honored to hear that, and glad to hear that I could play that role for you. I want to take a minute to acknowledge the person who did that for me. His name is Morris Head, and he was my manager supervisor at San Francisco State University when I worked at a place called the Campus Academic Resource Program, or CARP. And it was basically the TLC at San Francisco State. All 4 years that I was in grad school at San Francisco State, I worked for Morris. And I believe Morris started out as a history instructor in Louisiana, I think at LSU. And then he came to San Francisco State, and he worked, much like I did, as a classified staff employee supervising a tutoring center. And he, like what you said about an interview setting a tone, I learned that from Morris. And this is where, if Morris ever watches this interview, I have to acknowledge him for what he taught me, because I learned everything I know about interviewing people from Morris, and about the expectations that you set in the context of an interview. But one of the things I learned from him beyond any doubt is that people tend to look at tutoring as a remedial activity. What happens in tutoring centers is remedial. You go there because there's a problem of some kind, and it needs to be fixed. Or that it's not equivalent to what happens in a classroom. And my experiences, first of all, as a peer tutor, because I did that at Santa Barbara City College. I got my CRLP, I don't remember what that stands for exactly, but the certificate you have to get to be certified to be a tutor as a student, right?
Right.
1999, I was 19 years old. I got that at Santa Barbara City College, and I started being a peer tutor. I did it at San Diego Mesa College. But not until I got to San Francisco State and Morris was my supervisor did someone really sort of have the ethos about them that was like, tutoring is just as important as what happens in the classroom. And in fact, for some students, it's the thing that saves them, because the classroom environment isn't for them. They don't learn there because some teachers don't set up learning environments in ways that are going to benefit all students. There, you know, there's that top 5 or 10% that's going to be successful, but then there's a lot of the class that's just not going to get what they need from the classroom environment, and they need to go somewhere. They need to go somewhere to learn that. And tutoring centers quite often are those places on college campuses. And I don't know if I think it's a sad thing or not, because I think it's a wonderful experience to be a peer tutor. I know it convinced me to become an educator, because I thought, wow, I can actually help my peers and this feels good. And I know that I'm making an impact here. But quite often students bear the burden of helping other students succeed, and tutoring centers are where that happened. But I knew, as somebody who is responsible for hiring the Henrys of the world, that we're going to go out there and be peer tutors, that if I hired the wrong person, someone who didn't have it in them to be curious and giving and work with other students, I really didn't care what their grades were like in their classes. There's something you can get from talking to somebody about their willingness to engage with somebody else and their learning experience that doesn't have anything to do with how successful they are in their classes. And often people who've been unsuccessful in their classes become the best tutors because they know how to work with people who are struggling. I knew that I needed to take those interviews very seriously and communicate to the students that I was interviewing that it wasn't just like, hey, this is a student job and you can come here and be a tutor. it was, this is a really high degree of responsibility that as a student, you seem to want. And so I'm going to invite you to take that responsibility as seriously as you want to take it, because I know, having been through it, that it can literally save a student. Your interactions, Henry, like your interactions with students in the TLC saved some of them educationally. And I know it because not only them, but their parents came and told me, like, if it weren't for Henry, this student wouldn't have been successful in his class, right? He wouldn't have persisted. He wouldn't have graduated. So that's why you take it seriously, right? Because it is serious. I'm not going to say it's life and death, because at the point of the transaction, it really isn't. But that's a moment where a person, you know, either gets the support that they need from somebody who really genuinely cares about them, or they get blown off by a student worker who is there to collect a paycheck and isn't really into the interaction. To be a good tutor, I would even make the argument you don't even necessarily need to know the material all that well. You just need to be willing to work with the person until they understand it and be encouraging, right? I mean, that's often all there is to it. And so that's what I was often looking for in the interviews. But I knew that if I didn't demonstrate to you that I took it seriously and that I was going to hold you responsible for that interaction with students, that I was already starting by setting the wrong tone. But I owe that to Morris. I went through a lot of my educational career before I ran into someone who made that really clear to me. So
yeah.
I want to make sure I say that and acknowledge
what
Morris did for me.
Yeah, no, it's not.
and then look, here I am. Then that meant something to you too. So this is the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah, I mean, not only did you set the tone during the interview of helping me reimagine the possibilities of what this role of being a peer tutor means, but I would say, I mean, we worked some late nights in the TLC. And this is why I think of you more traditionally as a leader than a manager. I think managers do a lot of important work, right? There's a reason why managers exist. But I mean, for you to be there that late with me, closing down shop day in and day out, I was like, holy cow, if Josh is willing to work this hard to support the community at Foothill College, then I better, you know, keep up, right? Because that's that attitude that isn't necessarily set, but is reflected in your action. And I just remember not only the late hours, but just the sheer amount of work that you had to get done to do all the list of duties that were casted upon you. So yeah, I mean, I learned just so much from work ethic, from transformational tutoring, not transactional tutoring, right? I think my meeting yesterday with Catherine Lee, I was telling her about a brief story about us, about when I found out that you actually wrote some novels. And I was like, I think I was really struggling with some computer science at the time, and I somehow found that out. I think maybe Maria told me, but I was like, and then I had a conversation with you. I was like, Josh, you know what? If you can write a novel, I think I took a glance at it, maybe in the preview of the Amazon preview look inside thing. I was like, Josh, you know, you could be a really amazing computer scientist, because what is computer science besides stringing together a bunch of arguments and claims and statements and, you know, telling the story or solving a problem? I think at the moment you didn't believe me when I had said that, but it really is, right? So much of language is syntactical, but if you know the underlying principles of that language, of linguistics, of how to create a good argument, if you just learn the syntax of Java or Python, then you would be set. So Catherine's like, whoa, really? Is that right? yeah. Maybe this is a good time. I mean, I can really go on about reflecting on how much I learned from you, but maybe this would be a good time in talking about learning and just how difficult it is to pinpoint what that word means, right? To learn or what learning entails. So maybe we can begin by, if you'd be so kind to share with us your definition of learning. It doesn't have to be in an academic context, assuming that most of our audience is going to be students struggling with learning in their courses, maybe we can you know, focus it at, in an academic context?
Sure. Yeah, what is learning? This was a question, I was looking at that checklist of questions and I was really wondering how I was going to answer this one. Because I think it's a very, it's multifaceted, how you define learning. But so in an academic context, what is learning? There are the goals and objectives that your instructor has set for you. And I guess you could define that as learning. So you could get really clinical about it and you could pull up a syllabus and you could say there are learning objectives, right? Every course is supposed to have student learning objectives. I knew when I taught English 1A and 1B, for example, that what the students were supposed to learn was how to form a coherent argument that had solid support that was backed up by evidence and analysis. Those were meant to be learning outcomes. I suppose you could say that those were measurable by grades on essays or grades at the end of a class. But this is where I actually struggled as a teacher to evaluate learning. Because I know as a student and as a person that it's entirely possible to mimic learning without actually having learned anything, right? I mean, yeah. I've been able to perform a task without really any understanding of why I was successful or unsuccessful at that task. But I've got I can look back at classes I was in and say I had zero confidence that I was doing that correctly, but I pulled an A in the class. Right. So by definition, I learned something according to that course syllabus, and I was graded so. But as a person, I know that's not that learning wasn't happening there. I was performing functions for an outcome. So how do I define learning? I define it as growth, as mental growth, right? So it's, you didn't know something, either you didn't know a thing or you didn't know how to do a thing. And then you know what it is, or you know how to do it. And that process is often painful. That's one way I know that I'm learning something, is that I'm experiencing discomfort. I'm resistant to it. It buffers against my expectations. I guess one of the ways I used to try to ensure that learning was happening in my English class is one of my very first assignments would be, and this was, it was actually, it's harder than you would think, was first of all to define a thing that you're enthralled to, an idea that you're enthralled to, by which I mean a belief that you hold that you have never once investigated. Like you know it to be true, but you've never even investigated why you think it's true or know it's true, because we all have those things. Like, and I would start with silly examples. Like growing up, I knew that the 49ers were the best football team on the planet because I was a 49er fan. And that's kind of the idea behind being enthralled by something. Like if you're a fan, like you believe your team is the best against all evidence, right? Like the 49ers are objectively not the best football team. And they might've been in the 80s and 90s when I was growing up, but they certainly aren't anymore. But as a fan, I sure as shit believe that, right? And that, but well, how did I learn that they weren't the best? I watched them lose a couple of Super Bowls. And I was like, oh, yeah, they're not the best team. I learned. It was painful. It was uncomfortable. I had to reject all of my comfortable native assumptions about what I thought I knew. That was learning. And I can learn something different. So I guess I would define learning as that process of re-scripting something that you know, or building a script for something that you don't, to use your coding, like talking about computer coding. Mm-hmm. I feel like our brains are kind of that same way. And there's coding up there and we have to recode or uncode or code for the first time. But that we know when that's happening because there's a kind of cognitive dissonance that happens as it's happening. Like there's an actual conflict that happens there. And then you come out the other side with a fresh understanding of something. But I wouldn't say that's the end of learning, because in my experience, things that I've learned become challenged at some point in time by some new concept, and then I've got to relearn. And that's why professionals go through professional development training all the time, to make sure they don't stop learning, because stasis is comfortable. But you know you're learning because you're uncomfortable. So maybe that's the cleanest way I can define learning, is that I'm in a position where I'm uncomfortable, but I'm also slightly exhilarated because I know that I'm becoming stronger or better informed because of it, or my practice is going to become more useful because of this experience that I've been through. I think we're all learning because of COVID right now, just to expand this analogy.
Yeah.
We're learning some of the things that we took for granted by their absence. We're learning just how precious human interaction is because of its absence. And we're learning how selfish some people can be because of the way they're behaving. Learning is often a difficult thing. I think we put a lot of structure around it to make it more comfortable, but it's typically difficult. And it requires it's sometimes an act of courage to actually get through to the other side.
Wow. Your response here, Josh, I have listened to thousands of hours over the last 2 years of podcasts on people talking about learning. I have read probably close to thousands of pages for my literature review and my research on that Student Success and Equity grant on just how challenging learning can be. But I would say your presentation right there, your impromptu definition of learning is one of my favorites by far. And partly it's because I know you and I know that you actually have a lot more to say about this, but you're able to, you know, get it in a succinct way. But another part is like, that's one of the things, like you are like fascinating. And so many of people at Foothill College are really fascinating and really just intelligent and brilliant and, you know, really service-centered. And what bothers me when I'm doing my research in perhaps traditional academia contexts or doing my research in people who have a business on how to be productive and how to learn, it's like, man, my, like Josh knows like more than these guys, like how they get all the attention and they get all the fame. And I know you're definitely not in it for the attention and fame, like the role that, you know, the mission that we're all on, you know, at these institutions is fundamentally different than if I have a private company teaching people how to be productive, right?
I mean nothing against people who are in it to make money and be educators at the same time, but quite often I'm of the opinion that tethering money to learning leads you in the wrong direction almost every time, because the object of a business is to make money. And the way to make money quite often very effectively is to systematize things. And if we're paying attention to what's wrong with education, 99.9% of the time, it's that it's overly systematized. And that people don't learn well when it's a system, because we're all idiosyncratic in the way that we think, and we need to find someone who's willing to work with us to figure out, you know, what modalities work best for us, what kind of challenges we need. Like, I guarantee, I mean, you and I are fairly similar, Henry, but I guarantee you there are students out there that, like, you know, I took fairly well to the kind of a disciplinary approach to education. Like, I could have a teacher tell me, like, you're terrible at this, Josh. You're the worst I've ever seen. Go get better. And I'd go get better. But there are people out there who you tell them that and they would not come back. Right? There are a lot of approaches to being an educator. But being kind and working with the student pretty much always does the trick. And building a system that really just is there to, you know, on the one end, make you money is not going to really work for students, really, when you think about it, because that's not the aim of that system. The aim is to make you money. So, you know, with all due respect, I think that you're starting out from the wrong proposition if you're in it to make money. So I appreciate the compliment. But when I see stuff like that, I usually am very suspicious of any kind of enterprise that seems to me it's about education, but it's also about making money. Cause then I'm like, really? Like I respect that everyone needs to make a living, but that's usually when the red flags go up for me, when there's money tied to it.
Mm.
on a massive scale. I mean, places need to survive, right? I mean, colleges are about, like, they have to collect tuition. So I'm, you know, I understand that there has to be, there's a transactional nature to pretty much everything in education. But I do think at its core, that's quite often what's wrong with our educational system. Like, you can trace it back to something transactional that becomes a barrier to the people actually working together in a way that that brings about, like, real learning outcomes for people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to go off on a tangent here, but I could really talk about that one for a while.
Yeah, I have so many thoughts that come up.
Because people get scammed. This is where I get upset, is when people, you know, people get taken advantage of. People who really want to learn something, they're taken advantage of by people who are just trying to make money. It's really one of the oldest scams in human history, to find a vulnerable population. I think this is at its worst when it happens in education, people preying on the vulnerable. Because you got people trying to learn and improve their lives, and, you know, folks come in and basically just take their money when they're trying, you know, when they're trying to improve their lives. I find that deplorable.
Yeah. Yeah. We are all feeling the consequences when we live in a society where there's that imbalance, right? Like, we are literally feeling the consequences of that right now. I mean, there's a concept of shareholder supremacy that comes to mind immediately, right? Like, who are the real shareholders in the academy besides the most vulnerable, AKA the students, right? There's a professor at NYU, he's in the Department of Finance, his name is Scott Galloway, and I heard him speak in a YouTube little informal conversation like this one that he had with Andrew Yang on Yang's YouTube channel. But he says that, this is his words, not mine, every single year in that department, the deans get together and they boast about how many students they were able to reject that year. And he said that this is like tantamount to if you were to go to a homeless shelter and like boasting about the people that you rejected to come into your institution. I am fully aware I don't know the constraints of deans and admin in general, but when there is no collective definition of learning that exists in the classrooms that I am in the classes that I'm in, that causes a lot of misery for students who are, as you say, trying to better their lives, trying to pass, trying to get their degrees towards upward social economic mobility. And I recognize in the syllabus, there are learning objectives that are written, but I think in that idea, the standard of our ethics should be greater than what is written in law, for example, right? Like sometimes you'll have a perfect example of this is the Titanic. When the Titanic first sailed the seas, the largest ships were these ferries that were like 1/4 of Titanic size. And when the Titanic sailed, the amount of safety boats they had on ship was only the amount that was required for those small ferries, which is, you know, like they were missing 75% of safety boats and safety equipment for if a catastrophic event were to happen. And then what do you know, when Titanic struck the iceberg, about 75% of the people died, right? And that's where the Titanic broke no laws. But I think, you know, the standard of our ethics should be higher. And for the most part, for sure, I think I have a lot of respect and gratitude for people in education at large, right? Especially for people like yourself and, you know, teachers who really think about what learning is. But if they define learning as solely anecdotal experiences, like I survived, so you should survive the same way, or I went through the system, like it's just so different, because at the beginning of each term, the starting ground for each student is so drastically different, right? A prereq requirement checkbox is not enough to even get close to leveling out the playing field. And that's where, you know, I feel personnel is really policy. And I've been so fortunate to have people like you in my life to help me define learning subtly, right? Through your actions, through your leadership, and through the activities and all the discussions that we've had, I get to kind of break that apart and slow it down, because you've helped me do that.
That's awesome. You know, I wonder if as a country, we gave the resources to education that we give to the military, and if we valued every student the way that we value and recruit soldiers in this country, by which I mean, you know, like the government went out there and recruited low-income, underserved people to be successful in education as opposed to join the military, for example. If we threw all the money that we threw the military at education, I think it would be a wildly different system. Wildly different. I mean, this system isn't built to serve everybody, but if it was built to serve everybody and it had all the resources that it needed, and we're a country that had, we could resource education to the same extent that we do the military. We just have to change our priorities. Mm-hmm. But you know, you were mentioning like the constraints that deans have. Those are real. Like I understand a lot of these conversations are real, and then people end up laughing about very twisted, very sick things like denying students. When I hear something like that, I think about how broken and how sick the system is that you'd have deans that would find that humorous, right? That basically their lives have gotten so horrendous as deans that this is the kind of thing that they find funny. That's a really broken system. It's a terribly broken system. And of course, people have individual responsibility to put some pressure on there to make changes. But part of it is that if you just look at education, it doesn't get the resources that it needs, especially public education. With better funding, maybe the models would change. I don't know. But at its core, too, education's not really about what we need it to be, which is supporting democracy. It's about sort of reproducing a privileged upper class. That, I mean, that's where it has its roots in our country. Mm. So it has to not be about that. But our whole system has been founded on that model. So that very much needs to change. Mm-hmm. And I mean, can you imagine an educational system that didn't care about admissions requirements? It was just like, you want to be here, we want you to be here, let's make sure that you're successful. It would be a completely different system. Mm-hmm. But right now, like, you've got to write an essay to get into a college. Why don't colleges just want you to be there? I mean, have you just paused to think about that? Because this is the kind of thing I think about a lot now. Like the other day I was having a conversation with some of the administrators at Foothill, and I'm like, why do we make students apply for scholarships? Think about that for a second. We've got $20, $30 million, maybe it's $15 million in scholarship money just sitting there. We're supposed to give it to students who need it. Why do we make students apply for scholarships? Like, you have to write an essay. I guarantee you there are students who never apply for scholarships simply because they have to write an essay. And you could make the argument that writing the essay is a valuable experience, but should it prevent you from getting a scholarship? I know there's millions of dollars of scholarship money that doesn't get awarded every year because not enough people apply. So there's students who need scholarship money who aren't completing school, and we have it, but the requirement for getting a scholarship is to write an essay that people aren't going to write. Why do we do that? Like, it's a choice. We literally just made a choice to do that. Okay, so some of these things I don't understand. Like, the system, if you really start to think about certain things, it's not inviting. It's not there to encourage the majority of students to be successful. It's there to get a percentage of students through successfully. That needs to change. It absolutely needs to change. Why would we create a system of education that's only intended to get 10 to 20% of people through at the highest level? What's the function of that other than just creating a massive social sorting mechanism? I can't, like, that. So this is where I start to have ethical and moral problems as an educator. I'm like, is there really ever going to be a motivation to change the system, or is it designed to do exactly what it's doing? And then there are all these, you know, conflicted conversations that happen within the system, but the system itself never really has the motivation to change because it's doing what it's designed to do. this is my deepest fear, ultimately, at the end of the day, about education. Because I think about the education system, I should say. Because obviously there are wonderful things that happen in the system. People meet each other. They're successful. Some of the best moments of their lives happen in classrooms or tutoring centers or on college campuses. But there's something just fundamentally wrong about the system. I think we all kind of feel it. I think this is why my supposition is this is why the learning code exists, is that there's this need to fix this thing so that it works better for everybody.
Yeah, yes. Ever since I, actually started reading about some of this stuff about 2 years ago, I am now seeing so much that any normal student would not be able to see, right? Because what ends up happening is you think about the wherewithals that students need to have to be able to fail a course and then retake that course, to pass that course, or fail multiple times. But, what percentage of students have the wherewithals to be able to do that? And then what ends up happening is if they fail and they don't have these, the lenses on learning or the lenses on just how deficient the system is in really serving them and empowering them, they'll think it's their problem, right? They'll think it's like, oh, well, that's because we're at the mercy to the powers that be. But I think it's people like yourself, Josh, where I really think about, personnel as policy, right? It's people within the system along the fringes who are trying to drive real change one student at a time.
That is my hope, yeah, is that ultimately personnel is policy. Yeah. That is where I'm coming from.
To be able to sleep at night, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I really don't think you can affect change from outside of a system. I do think you have to. I mean, you can, but I really think it's most effective when you're in it.
Especially when I'm thinking about public education, big time. Because I mean, how am I going to reach the students who need the most help if I have my own LLC? It's not.
Yeah.
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 There's a funny video I want to send you. It's called A Nation Run by Billionaires by Anand Giridharadas. And he really calls out like how billionaires are not going to save us. Like we're living in this delusion of a philanthropical movement, but why is it that the gaps keep on deepening, right? One other thing I wanted to comment on that was, I remember, like, should we judge the worth of a society by the opportunities we give to the most remarkable? Or should we actually judge the worth of a society for the opportunities that we give for the majority, right? And generally speaking, for sure, education is doing the latter. That's their mission, right? We have statements like, we have equity statements, we have diversity statements, we have these mission statements. But in STEM education, because that's what I can speak on, because I know the most of it, I've been living through that pain for the longest, it's when teachers don't invest the time to think about, I think they do, for sure they are investing the time, but when they don't really critically think about who they're passing or who they're failing or what grades mean, or what learning can be, a lot of students not only are put in the system to be pitted against each other, to really compete against each other for these arbitrary grades, but really have a difficult time learning anything significantly. But that gets to the whole funding problem, right? Because as soon as a teacher has 100 students on their roster, it is really, really nearly impossible to meet every single learning need, right? It is possible in the sense that there are policies in the syllabus that you can put in place to even the playing ground, so to speak. But yeah.
I think it's fun. I think it's fun to judge by how we serve our most privileged, because that's where that's where the Academy Awards live. When you sort of escalate up the basic hierarchy of needs to like things like who am I as a soul in the universe? Let's talk about those things. Like that's just fun to talk about. Everyone loves talking about people who are doing well and doing amazing things. I'm going to pause right there. What I do think, though, is more a peek into sort of the actual morality of a culture is how the most vulnerable and struggling are treated, though. Like that's if you're thinking about creating an equal society and the work of equity, it's not about It's not about how you treat your most privileged populations. It's about how you treat your most vulnerable populations, because those are the folks who quite often, through nothing that they've done, just were born into a family that had already, through historical oppression in this country, not been given the proper resources and was already at a deficit, and is not set up to be successful in our educational system. Like, we should be judging ourselves by how we treat that person, not those who are already primed for success. That's just that, to me, that's just easy. And that's the kind of stuff. It's like, oh, great, you should celebrate your successes, but like, those are the kind of things that you would I expect people who come from comfortable, well-supported upbringings to be fairly successful. And when they are, I'm like, cool, you're doing as expected, and that's great, and congratulations. But I think we should take some pride and like really look at ourselves, if we're evaluating who we are as a people, is how we support our most vulnerable populations, or those people who we think are falling through the cracks, or who might not be successful. We don't have a great track record as a country when it comes to that. We tend to marginalize people and then make it incredibly difficult for marginalized people to then be successful. So I don't think our scorecard looks great. And this is where I have problems. I think education quite often celebrates. It'll, especially this time of year, as we're wrapping up the end of a calendar year, where there are all these celebrations of like achievements and stuff. And quite often I'm like, this is great and I love it and it puts a smile on everybody's face, but it would be better, I think, if we focused on what were our accomplishments with the food pantry, for example. Like, I've heard a lot of time, I've spent a lot of time in meetings lately hearing about students who've won awards. I have not heard, about students who are getting food at the food pantry, and those aren't seemingly the things that people are taking pride in. So yeah, that feels like sort of misplaced focus to me. To answer that question, I think we should take pride, if we're going to take anything, if we're going to take pride at all from how we serve those people who need it the most.
Yeah,
because that's where it actually means something. That's where it's impactful.
Yeah, I agree. I think the next talk, maybe we can actually get into the tyranny of merit and what merit means.
Oh boy.
Yeah. But for this one, I think earlier, Josh, you had actually captured many of the truths that cognitive scientists and people who study how learning works have published, which is like belief, right? Belief is a huge part of being able to, think about our cognitive dissonance, whether it's a subject matter at hand, whether it's a lecture, whether it's an assignment, whether it's an exam that we're prepping for, to then be able to think outside the box of how might this information serve me in my near and far future. And that conversation does not exist in so many students.
Yeah. Well, I think often there's not room for that in the classroom. And I think part of the reason is that a classroom isn't really designed for an individual student to have a revelation and share it with the class. But that is often what learning is for a person, is those moments of revelation. You're like, oh my God, I need to share this with somebody. But classes aren't set up for that. Otherwise you'd be sitting there for weeks on end, listening to each student individually talk about the revelation, and that's not going to serve, it's not going to serve the class. But yeah, those moments are amazing. But yeah, again, this is one of the reasons why I used to love working in tutoring centers, is that I felt like there was more space for that kind of thing to happen, right? Yes. Because an interaction with a tutor is not about, I mean, it can be about a syllabus or achieving an objective, but all of a sudden the other 29 students in the class are gone. And then it really becomes about that pure learning experience. I, Josh, am coming to you, Henry, because I just got an essay prompt and I have no idea how to form a thesis in response to this. And I need, I need to figure something out. I need to gain some understanding. And that one-on-one interaction is exactly the thing that's quite often missing from a classroom experience, because there's just not time to pause and do that with each student. It would alienate all the other students in the classroom. And that was actually one of the reasons I didn't mind when I had to pivot from being a classroom instructor to working in the TLC, where I was actually kind of excited for it, because it meant that I could put my grade book down. I didn't have to have an interaction with a student and go, okay, that was an A, or that was a B, or this was 10 out of 12, or, because that's artificial to the experience. And I can just focus on, did you get what you needed today? You came here because you had a question. Did you get that question answered? Or maybe, like, do you now have other questions that are going to lead you off on some really awesome journey that I was able to help you take? And you're not anxious about it because you're not worried about whether you're going to get graded or whether you've irritated the other students in the class because they've had to wait for you to get your question answered. How many times in a classroom have you not raised your hands because you thought, oh man, like if I raise my hand and ask this question, people are going to have to listen to me have this interaction with the teacher for the next couple of minutes?
20 times per class.
I mean, it was me quite often, because I'd have things, and then I would go talk to the teacher after class, but like I would, you know, stop myself short of extending my own learning experience out of deference to the other students in the classroom. Yep.
All the time.
Which is a courteous thing to do, but then you're stopping your own learning experience. There are a lot of things that get in the way of actual learning in the classroom. And this is why things like what you're doing with Jeff, right? With the learning code, these interviews, going to tutoring centers, building a community on campus, but also just ultimately thinking about your own learning experiences belonging to you. It's not on your transcript. It doesn't happen in the classrooms. I think ultimately you have to think of yourself as the master of your own learning universe. Mm-hmm. These classes that you take, they're all sort of cells in your body. They're very defined experiences. They all sort of have their own rules for operating. And once you're out of that cell, you're into some other domain where the rules are different and things behave a little differently. But all that kind of makes you up as a learner. And ultimately at some point, I think that the hope is that you, amidst all of that, can find something that has meaning for you, and that all of that education kind of starts to come together and crystallize into something that you can kind of like becomes a lens that you can look through and be like, oh my God, I can see something. Like, I have a direction here. I want to be a teacher, or I want to be a nurse, or I want to work in a tutoring center. Like, it all starts to make some sense. But I think at the moment, a lot of people have to, people get to that stage, but they have to go through so much nonsense to get there first, for that vision to kind of clarify and become real. But I'm looking forward to having more conversations with you about this. I know my conversation style is a little all over the place sometimes, but I really loved the kind of the free-flowing conversation that we had about this today.
Me too. I had multiple light bulb moments go off as you were talking, and I recognize that not all our audience members will have that, but that's one of the beauties of documenting our conversation in this way. They can slow it down. They can rewatch it a year from now. They can rewatch it 2 years from now, when perhaps they're more hungry to reimagine what learning is for themselves. Or perhaps they're positioned in a way that they have to reimagine what learning is for themselves. Right. I want to be really respectful of your time, but I do want to ask you one last question, which is there anything that I didn't speak on today that you would like to further elaborate, or any questions you have for me, Josh?
Yeah, I have a question. How do you define learning? I know this is a question that you're asking people who come on your show. How do you define it? I'm very curious to hear your answer.
Thank you for asking me the question. For now, I will borrow some words from my research, but I know Jeff has already adapted this definition by Ambrose et al. In her book, How Learning Works. She does a pretty awesome 40-minute workshop on that book that's available on YouTube that I'm happy to forward you if you like. But she defines learning as a process of change changes that involve beliefs, behaviors, attitudes, and knowledge. And that learning is something that no one can ever do to you, but that you really ultimately have to do yourself. So one goal of the mission code is the sooner you realize that you have to teach yourself, in a sense, the more agency and efficacy you'll have as you try to navigate your courses with meaning, with confidence and significance. And that's not easy, because at least in STEM education, it really does feel like an information dump, like a really, really big information dump. I always, you know, tell my friends, like, I'm lucky if I understand 5 minutes of lecture in those STEM classrooms. And what that really means is each lecture is a project in and of itself to break apart, right? Just like how a chapter of a book can be. But it also is an opportunity to reflect on some of my beliefs about that content, about that information, about the knowledge that the professor is professing to us. It's an opportunity to challenge some of my attitudes that I have about that material, right? And then hopefully I allow my behavior to drive my learning and not just, you know, get too stuck in the hypothetical of, like, you know, believing this or attitudes about this. And then ultimately, then we can transition into formulating kernels of knowledge, right? Like we can create a second brain for ourselves that we can then leverage to empower others. We can leverage to potentially make a living. All of that is like learning encompassed. But I loved your response on that definition, and I can't wait to be able to replay it because I wasn't taking notes. But that's the beauty of video.
I have one final question for you. Do you know that I'm really proud of you?
You've shared that on multiple accounts.
Okay, good. I hope you know that. I'm very proud of you, Henry.
Thank you, Josh. I hope I can grow up to be more like you one day. And
come on now.
Actually, in this book, Josh, called Creating Significant Learning Experiences by L.D. Fink, the taxonomy to be able to do so in here, one of the first ones that they write about is caring, right? Like in the Bay Area, especially, we're in such a fast-paced environment where it's like, who's IPOing next? Who's startup this, startup that? I know. But when I think about public good, and when I think about service, and I think about my local and immediate community, even in Los Altos, like there's so much opportunity to quote unquote IPO the minds of the next generation, the future of our world, that I just applaud you for what you're doing, how much you've been able to empower me and allow me to see myself in ways that I never was able to see. So thank you for caring about me. It really means the world.
Well, I do. I care about you very much. And I'm glad, as I said before, I'm glad to see you doing what you're doing, and it makes me very happy and proud in all the right ways. Not proud in that sense where I'm like, this is about me, but proud where I know it's about you. And happy to see what you're doing with your life. That makes me very happy. So I think this has to be about, for this to be effective for other people, quite often this has to be an act of love, being an educator, being a teacher, that you just want what's best for somebody. And I think that's an act of love. It's not about you. It's about what helps that other person be successful. Sometimes that's giving them distance from you. Sometimes that's giving them, you know, I don't know, giving them something tough in a moment, that, you know, that is going to be painful for them, but it will, you know, will make them grow. And sometimes it's about just being kind, but ultimately I think if you're coming from a place of love and caring, then you're coming from the right place. People tend to know that when you feel loved and supported, then you feel comfortable to take a risk. And I think education has to be about that. Quite often, people just aren't comfortable taking risks within the system because the margins are too thin and it feels like if you make a mistake, it's the worst thing in the world. But I think if people within our educational system feel loved, if they feel cared about, if they feel like making a mistake is okay, then they'll actually grow and they'll feel that, right? And then we'll support each other. And hopefully the system does what it's supposed to do, which is encourage people to grow. But there's a Frank Herbert quote. He wrote Dune. I'm just going to shorten it up here, but it's just fear is the mind killer. And my wife, Cindy, she's got kind of a clipping of that quote that we have up here in the apartment. And it's kind of the first thing I see every morning when I get up is that fear is the mind killer quote. But I think of it for a couple of reasons. One, which is in my own day-to-day life, to just try not to operate out of a place of fear, to try to come from a place of love. But I really believe that when we're operating in a place of fear, either in a classroom or in an interaction, we're not, our whole mind isn't functioning, right? If you're afraid, if you're worried you're going to be punished, or that you're wrong, or that, my God, someone's going to think something horrible of you, or you're going to embarrass yourself, that you're not operating on all levels. You're probably not taking things in. So I think if education can be more about that, about loving a person, about caring a person, and leading, you know, leading more with the heart. I mean, the head will follow, but lead with the heart. People will be okay. You know, I think a lot of people just can't. They're scared, rightfully so, with an education because of the consequences of not being successful. We know how dire they are. Right? If you're not successful, we know what that looks like, statistically speaking, for folks. But it seems to me like a fairly simple fix. But it means at its core that the system has to not be about meritocracy, like you were alluding to, and washing people out intentionally, but embracing people and saying, you belong here. I love you. I want you to get an education and be able to support yourself and support your family and pass that love on to the next generation. Not because I'm trying to prove to myself and my neighbors that I've got merit. Yes, I do. But because we live in a society and we're here to support each other, and what's better for a democracy than me and my neighbor both being super educated so we can make the right decisions on election day, you know, or we can steer our country in the right direction. Like maybe just leading with love is the way to go with education and not making it what it's been for such a long time, which is kind of like the meritocracy Olympics. Right. I know that, you know, the IB parents and IB high school kids that I went to high school with to probably, you know, hear me saying this and be like, oh, come on, man. You know, you went through it. You had a 4-point whatever GPA in high school. You got your diploma. Like, you got your accolades. Let's just have everyone go through the same thing. But we don't need to do that. We don't need to have everyone go through the same nonsense that we went through just to prove that they belong. I think we should just... Those of us who've made it through, we should tear that structure down and let something else evolve, something better, you know, that's more inclusive. And instead of exclusive, education should not be an exclusive system. And I'll just stop right there. Education should be inclusive and it should be about loving students. I think it'd be better if we just fundamentally led with those concepts. Tear everything else down. Maybe have people agree to a Hippocratic oath for educators to first do no harm. And build from there. I think that would be lovely.
You are a living embodiment of someone who leads with his heart. You have been that for me over the past 4 years. And that is why you are the first featured guest on this in our community. Since you shared with me a quote, I'll share one last quote and we'll end it there. In the words of Maxine Green, an American educational philosopher, I am who I am, not yet. So let us continue to see what structures we can build. I think one student at a time is a good pace in building those structures for transformative change.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Josh. I already cannot wait for the next time we can talk. Hopefully it'll be shorter than over a year, which was the previous time that we spoke today. Yeah. So
I would love to talk to you anytime. Anytime I have the time for it, I would love to do an interview with you or just catch up. So
sounds good. Yeah. Well, I'll figure it out. We'll coordinate. And I think you'll okay. settle in your winter schedule sometime in mid-January, and I will be able to do the same, and we'll touch base then.
All right. Well, happy holidays. And
thank you.
I will be seeing you in 2021. Have a whole new year.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm already so excited to rewatch this recording. This is like, this is so cool. I think one day, Josh, you'll see how cool it is that your words can be documented in this way, not only for, you know, us two to potentially replay and rewatch, but for others to, you know, an introduction to the systems that be, the hierarchies that be, and what learning can be.
I'm grateful you're doing this. I usually don't like going back and watching myself on tape. I'm a little self-conscious, but I am absolutely sure you're right. At some point, I will definitely enjoy going back and watching this, and seeing who I was and what I thought on what is today, December 23rd, 2020.
Yep.
This slice of Josh Pelletier in my existence.
Right.
And yeah, and then, you know, I'm looking forward to checking in again and seeing what I think the next time we talk.
Awesome. Me too. Okay, Josh, thank you so much.
Take care, Henry.
Bye.
Bye.